briefs and oral arguments in the case, and we would especially like to thank Ms. Foley, who took this case by appointment, and we appreciate your efforts on behalf of your client. The case will be taken under advisement. The next case on this morning's call is number 022889, Voice Stream Minneapolis Incorporated against St. Croix County, a Wisconsin political subdivision. Mr. Van Cleef.
May it please the court, counsel. Gary Van Cleef on behalf of Voice Stream Minneapolis, Inc. Your Honors, this case presents an issue of first impression for this court arising under the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Particular issue relates to the so-called anti-prohibition clause of the Telecom Act. And that clause, which is part of the regulatory scheme under the Telecom Act, which acknowledges on the one hand that local governments have placement authority with respect to this new technology, this personal wireless service technology. On the other hand, in order to have a uniform federal policy, there are significant limits on that placement authority. And one of them is that a local zoning authority cannot regulate in such a way as to prohibit or have the effect of prohibiting the provision of personal wireless services. There have been four circuit courts which have recognized that a single permit denial may arise to the level of a prohibition. As I said, this court has not addressed the issue yet. The district court judge in this case synthesized a test based upon the other four circuits. And that test by the district court was as follows. The judge stated, all circuits agreed that the availability of other less intrusive, feasible alternatives to close a gap in the provider's service to its customers will defeat a prohibition claim.
Now, is this a provider-specific standard or a industry-specific standard? In other words, do you have a gap if, in fact, other service providers are able to serve the area?
You do have a gap if other service providers are able to serve the area, and, in fact, that is the way the tide is turning in other circuits. I would call the court's attention to a case that was just decided last week Third Circuit, in which the court recognized that, backed off, if you will, the Penn Township decision of the Third Circuit, and recognized that you have to look at the industry. And that's because one of the policies of the Telecom Act is to promote a pro-competitive technological proliferation. So it would seem antithetical to that to look only at whether or not there's any coverage by any provider.
Is this element really operative in this case? Is the record really talk about what other providers can or can't do in this area?
It is not, Your Honor, and that is because if you look at Judge Crabb's decision in her statement of the undisputed facts, she recognized that it was undisputed that there is a significant gap in coverage in this area. Accordingly, if we're to look at the test that's been adopted by the second and third circuits, they have a test under the anti-prohibition clause in which they say, first, you have to determine whether there's a significant gap, and second, you have to determine whether the provider is proposing the least intrusive means of filling that gap. So we're only dealing in this case with the second prong, that is, if this court is going to adopt the test that was set out and announced in both the Second and Third Circuits in the Willis and the Penn Township cases. We don't have any problem with the district court's formulation of that test in this case. What we have a problem with is the district court's application of that test in this case.
But that leads me to a question that I have for you, because questions like what's the least intrusive facility that could be put, you know, both in terms of design and placement, and questions about technological feasibility are factually very complex questions, or they certainly could be. And here, I think an important part of the district court's opinion was her allocation of burdens of proof and the way that she chose to look at the administrative record. She looked at the administrative record, and she didn't say you couldn't prove that this tower you want to build is, in fact, the only thing that really will do the job. She says you never did come forward with an array of plans to show the local authorities, the county people, that this was the case, and thus it was, in a sense, a failure of proof on your part, and that the county was entitled, on the basis of this record, to conclude that there might be better alternatives out there. She basically sends you back to the drawing board. So I'd appreciate if you could address these burden of proof issues, review of administrative record issues that we have.
Your Honor, that is the heart of this issue and the heart of this case. As I stated before, the test that was formulated by the court talked about available alternatives and feasible alternatives. The problem we have here, and I know that this is a very fact-intensive area, and the courts are grappling with how to set parameters, but this case, we think, somewhat uniquely, presents a bright line, and the bright line is this. In this case, VoiceStream identified an area within the county where it was legal to put towers.
But who gets to create the exceptions? I thought there was a logical problem in your argument there. As current law stands, yes, you identified that, but it's the same people you were talking to who would have been able to grant a variance or change the ordinance if that area closer to the river, some of those set-off areas were, or the Park Service people also said that. I had the impression from this record, and I think Judge Pratt may have as well, that there was some negotiating room as to what you might do. And I'll just throw out an analogy to you. If you had been the government wanting to build this tower and you were preparing an environmental impact statement, you would have had to lay out in more detail than you did the alternatives that were considered and rejected. That's, I think, the essence of what was going on here.
Your Honor, my response to that is this. We have to bear in mind that there's a policy here to propagate this technology and do it in an expeditious way. There is local control
and the policy
over placement.
Right. As you know, this statute was heavily lobbied. And I mean, senators I know say they've never seen anything like it in their lives, the way this statute came about. So it strikes me as a court, in any event, we would need to give weight to every part of the statute, including the local control and the propagation of technology.
But here we have a unique situation in which the provider was able to meet its coverage gap by putting a tower in a site where it was specifically zoned to allow towers. And that was a considered decision by the county. They adopted their wireless telecommunications facility ordinance in response to the Telecom Act of 96. So they made legislative decisions on where they were going to allow towers and where they were going to prohibit towers.
But your tower was too high. I mean, people rafting down the wild and scenic St. Croix River were going to see your tower from wherever they were.
It was not too high. It was a little over half the maximum height allowed under the county zoning ordinance. This was in an agricultural district, in a farm field, if you will. That's where the site was that was proposed. It's a 180-foot tower. The ordinance says a maximum height of 300 feet is allowed in an agricultural district.
But doesn't it depend on the topography? This must have been up on a hill or something so that you'd get the coverage you wanted.
Yes, and what we're talking about is an area which is bounded, the coverage gap is bounded on the Minnesota side by Minnesota State Highway 95, and on the Wisconsin side by Wisconsin State Highway 35, with the St. Croix River Valley in between. And the area that was to be covered was Minnesota 95, Wisconsin 35, and the River Valley. There were very few legal options that VoiceStream could consider. Now, when a telecom provider is confronted with these various parameters, and it meets those parameters, and then is told, You have to look in an area that has been specifically zoned by federal and county law to prohibit these types of facilities, and you have to consider putting one in the protected wild and scenic river area. We think that crosses the line. We don't think that a provider has to endure that kind of a burden when it has met a site that legally meets, it has found a site that legally meets all of the local zoning requirements. That's changing the rules in the middle of the game. They made their legislative determinations on what they would allow, and they would have allowed, according to their ordinance, up to a 300-foot tower in this area.
But they, I don't think so. I mean, I guess you're assuming that they have no power in granting this permit. It's not like it was a pre-permitted area. You did have to go get a permit from
a special exception permit.
Special exception permit, and in deciding within the general zoning requirements which special exception permits they were going to give, they were taking aesthetics into account and the wild and scenic nature of the river. It's not much of a wild and scenic river if you see cell phone towers all over the place.
Well, we met all, and then the reason that they require a special exception permit is to make sure that the county imposed performance standards under the county's ordinance are met. And we met all of those performance standards. We were well below the maximum height. We met all the setback requirements. It was designed to accommodate at least two co-locators, because one of the county's policies and one of its goals was to try to reduce the number of sites. Another irony here, because they wanted multiple towers when we could meet this coverage gap with a single tower in a legally zoned area for towers. We also designed
Would this tower have provided access for others as well?
It was designed structurally to accommodate at least two other co-locators on the tower. And it was also designed in the ordinance preferred style of a monopole instead of a lattice tower. We're talking about a single spire. It was color coordinated, if you will. It was going to be colored in such a way to blend with its surroundings. And so all of these were the performance standards which presumably the application would be measured against by the county in order to determine whether or not they were going to issue the permit.
Could you tell me what you think our standard of review of Judge Crabb's opinion is? Because it sounds to me, from just listening to you, you essentially would like us to make a de novo determination of whether this tower should be there. And we're coming upon this after several layers, you know, certainly the state county administrative layers, which we've already discussed, and then on top of that, Judge Crabb's substantial evidence review of what the county did. So where do we fit into this?
Judge, you know, I think where this court fits into it, and what I'm asking this court to do, is draw a legal line. And the legal line, as I said before, is a bright one in this case, and that is when a provider has come forward and met all of the local zoning requirements and is denied a permit because it is told that an available, least intrusive, feasible alternative is to go into an area, a nature area that's protected by federal and county law, that can't be the law. I think the court has to draw the line and say, yes, there is a requirement by the provider to show that it has investigated and that this is the least intrusive, available, feasible alternative. But that reads out availability and feasibility. It's not feasible.
It's
legally.
The first part of your sentence that I'm having trouble with, because either the St. Croix County Board of Adjustment did or did not have the power to decide what criteria it was going to use for granting a special exception permit. And you're essentially asking us to say that they made a mistake of state law in turning you down, that in fact state law compelled them to grant a special exception permit when certain objective criteria such as tower height, agricultural land, and the like were met. And I have difficulty with that.
Well, Judge, one of the reasons that state law would compel that is because of the incredibly onerous standard for granting a variance under Wisconsin zoning law. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court even concedes that it is nearly impossible to obtain a use variance under the standard in Wisconsin. And under these facts, it would be truly impossible, because we have shown that we can meet their ordinance and place a tower where they say it's allowed, and we would not be able to show, it would be self-created hardship on our part if we came in with a variance application. And don't you think that even if the county and the National Park Service, to the dubious extent that they could allow a tower within there, don't you think that they wouldn't be challenged by any one of a number of interest groups in making that decision, and they would have a very strong case in the Wisconsin state courts that granting a variance under these circumstances was legal error.
But you notice all the ifs in your sentence. If you had come up with a proposal that had all of those set forth and the county board had just shot down all of your proposals, I think you'd be in a very strong position to say an effective ban has been imposed on us. That's inconsistent with the Telecoms Act. You can't do that. You have to find something that will work. Although, as you know from our Erger case, it doesn't have to be like every single community, every place. But in general, we all know this is an underserved area. But I guess in the end, and there's that sort of warning at the end of Judge Crabb's opinion to the county board saying, you guys have got to be reasonable and you can't play this game of shooting everything down.
Judge, it seems so perverse that we are being told that we have to investigate in an area that's federally protected as a wild and scenic river to erect towers when we can show that we meet the local ordinance. I think that turns this whole regulatory construct under the Telecom Act on its head to put that level of a burden on the provider. And I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, so I will reserve the rest if you...
Thank you, Mr. Van Cleef.
May it please the court. My name is Mark Steichen. I represent the defendants, appellees, St. Croix County, Wisconsin, and the St. Croix County Board of Adjustment. The problem with VoiceStream's application is that VoiceStream did not meet its burden under Wisconsin law to show that its application met all the requirements of the St. Croix County Zoning Ordinance. One of the requirements under the tower ordinance enacted by the county is to show that it provides the most visually the least visually obtrusive alternative for providing coverage. I think a careful review of this record will show that the board and opponents of this tower were consistent in saying not that they rejected any towers to provide coverage, but that they recognized the need to provide coverage, but that there was broad support for the idea that having more towers but shorter towers would be less visually intrusive. We have two federal policies at stake in this case, not just the Telecommunications Act, but also the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. The St. Croix River Valley was one of the first rivers designated in 1972 as a wild and scenic river. That is federal recognition of the extraordinary scenic qualities of this area. Under that law, Wisconsin and St. Croix have enacted regulations to protect and maintain the scenic quality of this area. Now, why would having more towers conceivably be less intrusive than having a single tower? It's because of the height and what you can do if you have shorter towers.
Could I ask you, though, I mean, Mr. Van Cleef, I think, makes a persuasive point when he says it's one thing to ask providers to come up with a couple of different alternatives, each of which might fit within the contours of existing law. It's quite another thing to ask providers to just throw everything out the window and come up with sort of a tabula rasa set of alternatives, even if they violate every statute ever passed by Congress, every Wisconsin statute, and so on. Isn't that an unreasonable burden for them to come up with things saying, well, if this were repealed and if that were repealed, we could do some other things?
If that were the case, it may be unreasonable. That's not the case here. There are several ways in which multiple tower scenarios could have been put in place. For one thing, the VoiceStream itself acknowledged in documents that were submitted that it had considered at some point a four-tower alternative that would have involved 80 to 100-foot towers. Three would have been located along Highway 95 in Minnesota, one along Highway 35 in Wisconsin. We don't know where those towers are. VoiceStream's documents say, well, we didn't go further because they might not have been permitted. There might be some setback requirements. We don't know
if... Who controls the setback requirements on those two highways?
It would probably be St. Croix County for Highway 35, and I assume it would be the equivalent county in Minnesota that would control for Highway 95. But we don't know because there was never any explanation of this alternative provided by VoiceStream. If there had been, we would have something concrete that we could look at. Part of the problem in this case is that we're dealing with a vacuum. But there are also other ways. The St. Croix Ordinance does not prohibit any wireless facilities in the riverway. It does permit, with a special exception permit, antennas to be located within the riverway if they extend no more than 20 feet beyond the structure that they are attached to. Again, St. Croix's documents state in the environmental assessment that there were, quote, almost no co-location opportunities, unquote, in the riverway. Well, that implies that there are some co-location opportunities. Where are they? We don't know because VoiceStream hasn't provided that information. We do know that the city of Marina on St. Croix is located within the riverway. There are structures in the city of Marina on St. Croix. It is certainly conceivable that there are places in which antennas could be placed in Marina on St. Croix and that they could be camouflaged or concealed. There's been development of rather clever means of disguising these antennas so that they blend into the area.
Could I ask you if VoiceStream ever put on the table before St. Croix County any elaborated proposal for an alternative to the monopole that they would like to have?
No, they didn't, and that's the problem. That's what the board was very clear after the first hearing in saying what we would like to see is a multiple tower proposal, and if you can't do that, then in the alternative, explain to us why you can't. And if they had come back with that information and said, here's why, here's what we've done, here's the information, we've considered this four tower proposal, these were the locations, these are the ordinances that would prohibit it, these are the requirements that we would have to have met, we would have to have obtained variances, here's where we might, these are the possible co-location scenarios that we have, and this is why we've ruled them out. It would be an entirely different case. And if that were the case, the board might well have said, all right, we'll approve this because there aren't any other alternatives. But VoiceStream didn't do that. We know from the scanty records that were provided that VoiceStream was aware of some co-location opportunities in the riverway. We don't know where they are. We don't know what they are. We know that they at least thought about a four-tower proposal. We don't know where those towers would be. We don't know, therefore, which jurisdictions would have had control over it, and therefore we don't know what restrictions there might have been. There was no opportunity then for St. Croix County or the Minnesota-Wisconsin Boundary Area Commission to meet and say, all right, why don't we get together and decide, if we need to have a multi-tower proposal, if that's best for the St. Croix River, then we'll, agree to this if, we can put towers over there. We couldn't do any of that kind of planning.
Now, would you agree then that if the district court's decision were allowed to stand, there could come a time that the St. Croix board would have to approve this tower?
Absolutely.
If all of that gets put in front of it.
That is certainly a possibility. If VoiceStream comes back and says, here is the proof, we cannot do it because this is what we've looked at and it's impossible, it is certainly within the realm of possibility that the board will have to approve this proposal. there are other legal means of placing towers and antennas in the riverway. One of them is to obtain a variance from the county. The variance is a recognized procedure for this exact situation. Special exception permits are required even in agricultural districts in the county because there's a recognition that you cannot set regulations in advance for every conceivable possibility. If this were an agricultural district, if this location were in an agricultural district that were 3 miles away from the river, there might not be any problem with it.
Is it the same board? Is it the same county board of adjustment that would be in charge of giving the kind of variance you're talking about?
Yes, it is. The other means is to place towers on National Park Service land. And this is one area where I think Judge Crabb misunderstood an argument that the board had made. Judge Crabb discusses preemption of the county ordinance under the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. The county and the board have never taken the position that the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act preempts any state regulation. In fact, she lays out very well how the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act is implemented through state and local regulations. Our point is that some of the land in the riverway is owned by the federal government. Some is simply regulated by the federal government. The National Park Service said repeatedly in the hearings that it had on repeated occasions told VoiceStream, look, we think that a multiple tower proposal may be a better option. We are willing to entertain proposals. We're willing to sit down and talk to you about placing towers on federal land. Now, if it's federal land, that the National Park Service is given express authority to grant easements for telecommunications facilities, and it's expressly allowed to grant easements within wild and scenic river areas. So if the National Park Service were to grant such an easement, it's our position that the Supremacy Clause would preempt the county or the state from denying that ability. But even if that's not the case, certainly I think Judge Crabb read the record correctly that the board and the county and the National Park Service have the same goal in mind. How do we protect the scenic resources of this area? So if the National Park Service were to grant an easement, it would certainly be within the board's authority, and I think it's likely that the board, if necessary, would grant a variance for a multiple tower proposal. So there are a number of different ways in which VoiceStream would have the ability to place antennas and or towers in the riverway as part of a multiple tower array.
And do we have any engineering data to suggest how good a substitute this multiple tower option is for the single taller tower?
We don't have any engineering specific information because, again, we don't have any configuration. However, the engineers for VoiceStream did testify that it is technically feasible as a general proposition to replace the single tower with a multiple tower array, but they didn't look into that because they were told that they couldn't put any antennas in the riverway. The county's outside consultant, technical consultant, also testified that it is feasible to replace the single tower with a multiple tower array, and that VoiceStream has done so on other occasions. I think there's substantial evidence in the record to support the board's decision. There is discussion on aesthetics or debate on whether or not there's sufficient evidence to uphold the board's decision on aesthetics. But if there was ever a case in which there was a basis to regulate the location and size of the tower based on aesthetics, I think this is the case. This is not a case in which the board has in any way delayed acting on proposals. When the applications were submitted, the board scheduled hearings quickly. On both occasions, VoiceStream asked that the proposals that the hearings be delayed. When the board gave very clear directions on what it was that it wanted, it was up to VoiceStream to come back, and the delay or the length of time was really up to VoiceStream. So I think we have a case of the board and the opponents acting in good faith, looking for the best means of providing service in this area.
And just one quick final point on standard of review. What's your position on that issue for this court now? What deference do we owe? Who has burdens of showing the board was either right or wrong?
On the on both issues, the court has de novo review of Judge Crabb's decision. When we go beyond that, certainly on the substantial evidence test, a great deal of deference is owed to the board. The board is the one that decides the weight and credibility to be afforded the evidence. The board is the one that decides how to apply the facts to its own standards. It's a difficult case in terms of the prohibition test because to define exactly what the standard of review is because it's entangled, I think, with the substantial evidence test. But the burden of proof, I think, is clearly on both, on the provider. State law in Wisconsin is that an applicant for a zoning application has the burden to show that it has met the standards. The Telecommunications Act expressly states that nothing in the Act changes state law unless expressly provided for, and the Act does not change the burden of proof. And all the circuit courts that have addressed the issue have placed the burden on the provider on the prohibition issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stikes. Mr. Van Cleve, you have 4 minutes.
I would respond to opposing counsel's point about the Wild and Scenic River Act and what it's intended to protect by pointing out that it's intended to protect more than simply scenic views, but also the land itself and the resources that fall within the bounds of it. So we have to consider how to reconcile constructing and erecting towers within the riverway with this federal protection that protects not only the scenic values, but also the trees and the bluffs and all the other natural features of that riverway itself.
Can a tower that's even taller than the one you're proposing, I think if another 30 feet, you'd have to have lights on it. So could a single tower further away be still observable from the...
Yes, Your Honor, and that's a good point because it brings in something that hasn't been discussed here this morning, and that is there is one other layer of government that we haven't acknowledged, and that is the town of Somerset, and they supported VoiceStream's proposal. They approved that proposal. It was within their jurisdiction to review that, and they approved it. They appeared before the county board of adjustment with a petition of 125 names and said, "We want this tower here," because one of the alternatives, and there were many alternatives, Judge Wood, that were considered by VoiceStream. I count no less than 9. Was a 250-foot tower farther to the east. When you get farther away from the river, it's got to go up higher so it can see down into the river. And as you pointed out, Your Honor, when you get over 200 feet, the FAA requires that a strobe light be put on it. The fact that this monopole that was proposed was 180 was another feature that we submitted showed that we were trying to fit within the confines and the constraints of the county zoning ordinance by having an unilluminated tower. But I do want to talk a minute about some of the other alternatives that were considered by VoiceStream. There was the old creamery site. That would have required a 250-foot lighted tower.
How much of this did you put before the board, and in what detail? I guess
this is all in the record, Judge. It is all in the four-volume appendix. It's not true that there was scant information. There were many, many meetings over 2 years over this tower site and talking and debating about other alternatives. We've got the old creamery site. We've got farther east on the Haas site. That'd be 250-foot lighted towers. There were 5 silos that the engineering expert hired by the county said, Why don't you look at those and co-locate on them? We looked at those sites. Three of those sites, if we put antennas on them, could cover Highway 35, but you couldn't see into the river valley. You'd need another tower on the bluff to do that. And so the problem that you get, and the undisputed facts we submit in this record, are that whenever you go off what VoiceStream proposed, you're in a situation where you've got to have something that can see into the river, which means it's got to be up on the bluff. Even it's going to be visible no matter what you do. Marine on St. Croix was suggested as an option. That town is an historic district. Can you imagine what would happen if VoiceStream went in there and proposed to put a facility in that town? And of course, that is one of the considerations, and the state historical preservation offices get to weigh in on that. They would have a great deal of problem with it. All in all, we're in a situation where we're completely boxed in. We have an undisputed coverage gap here, and we submit that this was the least intrusive, available, feasible alternative. And we think this court should recognize that and reverse the decision below. Thank you.
We thank both Mr. Van Cleve and Mr. Steichen for their arguments today, and the case will be